Where are you going to take him to? His garage? Or a vendor? How are you going to get him there? When are you going to evacuate those records? When you see the smoke coming out of the office down the end of the hall, or are you going to wait until the fire alarm goes off? And how are you going to access and manage those records once they've been transferred? Tape backup, that's like it's your normal end of day tape backup. Data replication, that's where the data is replicated at one or more sites. And similar to that is a term called, it's mirroring. That's where it's made simultaneously at a primary and secondary site. Backup, data rep, and mirroring are IT responsibilities. So you want to get with your IT person or persons and find out if those are viable options for you. And dispersal. How many of you, on a routine basis, send reports or documents to another court or another agency? Probably several of you. That's routine dispersal. And then there's planned dispersal, where you duplicate and distribute copies of records for the purpose of protecting them, such as taking your backup tapes and putting them off-site, away from that main facility. A little bit more about evacuation, about where would you take your records to? Right away, I think a lot of people think vendors, right? A commercial storage facility. Some states allow local governments to store records at their archives or their records center. Right now, the legislature does not allow us to allow to store records for local governments, but we're hopeful that very soon we will be allowed to do that. And when that happens, there'll be banners and whistles on our webpage to let everybody know. So in the interim, what would be another option or two for you if you're going to take a look at possibly the evacuation measure? Okay. In town, at least, but... Good. Do you all just have one building, one office, or do you maybe have a satellite office somewhere else? I don't know. Do any of you? Or you just, your one building, one court is right there? Do you have agreements with maybe sister city? Reciprocal agreement type thing? I like the quid pro quo kind of little thing. We'll store some of your records, you store some of ours. For disaster preparedness type things, something to consider. I don't know if that's possible, but you would know better if you have a good working relationship with another court in a nearby town or city. Maybe that's something you want to look into. So, now if you go back to our friends there in Danville, now what I'd like for you to do is you're going to flip, there's another little chart there, and you're going to take those records you identified and now jot down what you want to do, what you think they should do to protect those records, what sort of measures should be implemented. And we'll do that one out loud. And I'm not going to use that pen because now my thumb is as blue as this cap is. Mark with your defective markers up here. To have an exterminator come in, take care of the varmints. Okay. So what's do an inventory, see what you have. And earlier I said you need to know, have a list of your essential records, and you need to know where all of your records are. So if you do that inventory, attention, and if it's complete, if it's accurate, if it's detailed, you should have the answers to those. You'll know where everything is. You'll have a list of your essential records. Okay, good. What else? Sorry? Restrict access. Okay. Whatever that takes. Yeah, I don't remember. Does it even say anything about a lock? I don't think it does, but nothing that a good swift kick wouldn't take care of, or maybe alarm system? Yeah. We can make assumptions. Okay, if it doesn't say there's one, they don't have one. So we employ our experts, maybe, huh? Get the police and the fire folks to come in and say, what do you guys think?
Okay.
Could do that, yeah. Could do that. What's with the windows? Isn't there something with the windows? Okay. Didn't it say the windows do not open? Is that a good thing or not a good thing? Okay, just get you thinking. It depends. It keeps you what? Keeps you in, yeah. As long as there's not bars on it, right? Bars is, ugh. What else? So, thank you, okay. Yeah, we... environment. So we got humidity and temperature. So I'm going to touch on that a little bit more later. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Anything else you can think of that might be a good thing to do? Okay. Good. Elevate the records. There's two strategies for handling risk to your records. One is called acceptance, where you basically do nothing. So you've got records on in the basement. You have no additional funds and nowhere else to put them. You accept the risk to your records. Then you have mitigation, where you take steps to try to minimize the impact of any of your records. So we could move our records onto metal shelves at least 6 inches, which is the current recommendation, at least 6 inches off the floor. Maybe better to completely move them out of there, but you have nowhere else to move them, but at least it's, and let's get them at least half a foot off the floor. Questions? We said you need to make sure you can access your records during and after. There's two things you need to look at. And we're going to talk about each one of these. Some of your records, some of your essential records, you're going to need immediately when an incident occurs. Others can wait a little while, and it's going to depend on the type of records. I've been asking my coworkers to change that first color, and I keep losing out. They like the red. I know it's hard to see, but it says priority one. Think of your essential records that you're going to need to access within the first 12 hours after an incident occurs. There's a few examples that might fall in that category. This is the term we use is priority access, or access priority. What else might be up there? What are some other types of records that you're going to need in the first 12 hours after a fire, after whatever that emergency or disaster is? Yeah, what do you think? Okay. Okay, good. Think of anything else? Type of record in your court you're going to have ours after an incident occurs. Records you're going to need in the first 12 to 72 hours are priority two. There's a couple examples. Not set in stone, but these are just some possible examples. What about the first category I was going to suggest too, what about maybe the location? If you have cleaning materials in any of your buildings, some of those might be hazardous. Maybe you have system backup tapes on site. You might want to get those in the first 12 hours. Priority two, do you have anything like payroll in your offices? And retirement records that might fall under priority two. And records you need after the first 72 hours fall under priority three. A couple examples there. Might also include things like contracts, maybe EEO files. Just remember that whenever an incident occurs, you're going to have limited time and resources to access your records, your essential records. So, well in advance, decide what records you're going to need and how soon. And you probably want to have it written down somewhere. This just gives a little more information. I don't know how well you can read it in the book, but again, it talks about these priorities, these three access priorities, to get you thinking about those records that you have, your essential records, and how soon following an incident you're going to need to access those in advance of that disaster or emergency. It's not going to do you any good to be thinking about it in the middle of it. Do you have a question, ma'am? Huh? Might be a good example, yeah. Yeah. Hopefully that the fire doesn't start in the back or whatever. Or up front and you can't get to them. Or just, this is just to get you to think about this. You want to make sure that your essential records are current. And that the information, you know, the information in your records are current, and that the records are still considered to be essential. Because if they aren't, well, then you don't have to do certain things, right? So, because essentially you have to identify and protect. So, and a way to do that is to cycle them, to periodically replace or update those records, and that can be done daily, weekly, monthly, annually. Your call. It's going to depend on the content of the record. It's going to depend on the medium records in, paper, film, fiche, electronic. And it's going to depend a lot also on the access priority. How soon do you need it following that incident? Document this stuff. You know, how often, if you're going to cycle, how often are you going to do that? Who's responsible for it? You're going to evacuate the records should an incident occur. What did we say? Some of the things you have to consider if you're going to evacuate your records? Where are they going to go? What else? Who's responsible for getting them to where they're going to go? How are they going to be transferred over? Who's going to have access to them once you take them to that other site? Can I go? Probably not. Better not. But that's written down. And just like any other policies or procedures, it should be written down. And you and your coworkers should sign acknowledgement to that. Make sure everybody understands who's responsible for these things and what's going to happen. So when an incident does occur, you know what to do. You're not going to have time to think about it. We're going to talk about how you plan and respond for a records emergency. What I want to first do is I'm going to show you, now if you need to get up, use the restroom, did anybody need to do that? I have a video I'm going to show you. And it's called Ready for Anything. It's about a company that they talk about how they get together and discuss the what-ifs as far as emergency preparedness for their overall operations. And you're going to see there's an impact on records. And they practice it. And it points out the importance of practicing and preparing for it, thinking about these things well in advance, and they end up having a real disaster occur. And it shows how them talking about it and being prepared saved them a lot of money and a lot of headache. Any restroom needs? This is going to be about 20 minutes. Yes? No? Good.
That was there then, before disaster struck. Now they tell you something different. Be ready for anything. In continuity planning, you go in the principle that things that never happen do happen. A business recovery team's job is to plan for that. To think about questions like, if we were to lose our base of operation, would we lose it all? What can we do to prevent or mitigate that loss? What can we do to survive it? Not many months ago, our answers to those questions were tested by an actual disaster. We came through okay. Nobody was hurt. We got right back on our feet. Lucky? We weren't lucky. We were ready. You have to be, especially nowadays. Being ready for anything, and I do mean anything, has to be a part of your way of life.
Great. Thank you very much.
This is the core of our business recovery team. We get together to talk about how major disasters and small disasters put some organizations out of business.
This story tells about an explosion and fire that gutted a government document storage and record center. Many of their digital backups were still on 5 1/4-inch floppies with degraded quality and out-of-date software, and there was what was described as a scavenger hunt for floppy disk drives and software from the 1980s.
Risk assessment today has to include some worst-case scenarios that were inconceivable not long ago.
What if a group of armed and angry people invade one of our facilities and take hostages? The standoff drags on for 9 days. Now, could we protect our other employees, coordinate with law enforcement, and ensure that functions in other facilities remain secure?
Suppose miles from headquarters, a credible bomb threat closes down a service provider that processes our accounts records and our credit links, our electronic ordering. 55 hours later, we're still waiting for the all clear. Would we have alternate resources standing by?
Suppose an airborne contaminant forces a quarantine of one of our facilities while they decontaminate. We'd be locked out for an indefinite period. Within a matter of days, we'd have to relocate key operations, find and furnish workspaces for 2,000 workers, install communications links, and buy or lease a couple of thousand PCs.
I thought I missed winter.
Would we be able to do all that?
Suppose a computer virus sneak attack shuts down our systems for 48 hours.
We've been there, Bill.
When our big disaster hit, we were ready, because a year earlier, we had been warned by a so-called small disaster. At the time, our disaster recovery plan was way out of date. When the plan was written, nobody called a problem that shuts you down for a few hours a disaster. They called it a glitch. Today, a glitch can lose millions of dollars a minute. Our million-dollar glitch was a computer virus.
Susan was working at home. She got what she thought was email from a friend. The message warned about a new computer virus. Susan forwarded it to coworkers. The email was not really from a friend, it was from a hacker. The message warning about a virus contained a virus. Many recipients forwarded the message to others. They in turn sent it to still others. The virus began disrupting operations. My first thought was, we'll be back to normal in a couple of hours. But this new virus was destructive. It was hidden, and it spread like wildfire. Even recent backups were infected. While we tracked it down, network use had to be stopped company-wide.
The disaster recovery plan we had at the time was based on assumptions that didn't fit the real world anymore. The plan assumed we could take days to restore operations. We learned we couldn't. A new plan would have to assure continuous operation for essential functions. We'd assumed we'd be dealing with only a few key departments. Within minutes, the virus attack involved departments, customers, and suppliers around the world. Our new plan would have to be universal, covering the entire organization. The plan had assumed that key people would be at their workstations. After a few hours, many just gave up and went home. A new plan would have to assign specific responsibilities in case of emergency. The plan had assumed that only one thing at a time would go wrong.
This one right here.
But the virus resulted in a cascade of shutdowns. Email, instant messaging, intranet, intranet, and communications coming in and going out. In case of multiple failures, we would need alternate ways to keep communications open.
The plan assumed everyone would follow the plan, but a few people made end runs around the scheduled priorities, like Ed Hanlon.
Larry, I know. We're supposed to wait our turn. But if I do that, I'm going to be 2 weeks behind. I need to finish a data search now. Just slip me up to the front of the queue so I can get back online. What difference does it make? Hey, Larry, you owe me one, remember? So? Okay. So now I owe you one. Thanks, buddy.
Putting Ed at the front of the line pushed more essential operations back. In the future, strict priorities would have to be complied with.
The plan had assumed an in-house problem would stay in-house. But reporters were everywhere, questioning employees, suppliers, even customers. A TV crew taped one of our people outside on day one.
Your entire organization has been shut down by a computer virus.
Well, we're on top of it. We should have it cleared up, in fact, in a couple of hours. This virus that we have, it's not just computer sniffles. It's more like computer plague, like digital black death, PCs being carted off to the mass burial grounds. But we should have it cleared up by today.
Thank you.
And based on that soundbite, the press turned our two-day problem into their corporate horror story of the week.
At corporate headquarters, a computer virus is putting computers in the graveyard.
Like digital black death.
In the future, employees would need to understand why a designated press representative has to handle all inquiries from the media.
The plan assumed clients would be there when we recovered. But while we worked on our virus problems, we left clients out of the loop. Today, if a client can't get through to you for a couple of hours,
meantime,
they're hurting, and they let you know
business.
It.
Do you know that your system has been down for 2 days?
That's why I'm calling, to tell you why we had to go offline Monday.
Why didn't you call Monday?
I hear you've got some sort of black death virus, and your computers are being carted out and buried in some landfill.
That's just a rumor. Somebody's idea of a joke.
When I don't hear from you for 3 days, it's no joke.
Look. I'm sorry.
We can't take chances doing business with an outfit that drops off our screens and off our phone lines for 72 hours.
In the future, our continuity plan would have to keep us in touch with customers, suppliers, the public, and each other.
We lost 20% of our business. The press was all over us. Our stock dropped 9 points. Some clients threatened to sue for breach of contract. A group of shareholders were ready to sue the directors for failing to assure that we were prepared to continue operations. That whole event was a loud wake-up call. We'd been down for only 39 hours. What would happen if our problem lasted for 39 days or 39 weeks? We had full support of management to create a fully effective business continuity program. We started planning as if the next disaster was staring us in the face. Management formed a business recovery team to review disaster readiness and rewrite the business recovery plan with input from public relations, facilities engineering, human resources, safety, communications, legal, finance, sales, inventory, and procurement. The team did a walkthrough of all our major locations to assess the risks at each facility. Local teams studied maps of geological fault lines and floodplains, long-term weather histories, train, truck, and water routes for hazardous material shipments, power grids and cable and wireless networks, and got recommendations from state and federal agencies about a wide range of hazards.
We looked for ways to mitigate hazards through preventive measures, starting with security. Restricted access to grounds, offices, parking. Security checks on employees and enforcement of employee and visitor IDs. Visitor escorts and records. Security awareness training.
In the interest of prevention, we made physical changes. At headquarters, with a river nearby, we relocated servers and on-site record storage from the basement to an upper floor.
In one district with a high risk of power outages, they upgraded backup generators and dispersed critical functions to other power grids. In another city, people couldn't get to work if a tunnel under their bay were to be shut down. So they leased record storage and an alternate work site on the other side of the bay.
In any workplace emergency, the first order of business is get people to safety. The next order of business is to be ready to assist people with things like housing and transportation, maybe even counseling. The plan would require evacuation drills to improve the time it took to empty the building. Fire and police departments made a number of suggestions about improving warning systems and mapping alternate exit routes. Employees were selected for emergency response teams and trained in everything from the use of fire extinguishers to first aid and CPR.
We analyzed the possible business impact, determined which critical operations might be disrupted, and projected the financial and operational effects for various levels of disruption.
We prioritized our business processes and set recovery time objectives for restoring operations based on these priorities. Some work on local PCs could be saved to servers, backed up nightly, and stored off-site, where it could be recalled in a few hours. Where functions had to be continuous, transactions were mirrored simultaneously at a remote center, and backups were stored off-site, offline, and out of reach with our data storage service.
Each regional operation named its own business recovery team to develop a local contingency plan and set up a business recovery center. Backup personnel and outside contractors were cross-trained to fill in for any key person who might be out of action.
Backups were shipped on a regular schedule to a climate-controlled, secure record center away from the main operation.
The crucial thing in any continuity plan is testing. We simulated an emergency and found some problems, fixed those, revised the plan, and ran another test. That showed we needed to test and update the plan every 6 months. Before we could try it out again, the plan got tested for real. One of the most destructive forces in the world is plain old rainwater. In April, we had days and days of heavy rain. 50 miles up in the hills, rivers started to rise. Volunteer brigades were bagging the riverbanks, even though they hadn't seen flooding in our area in over 100 years. We put our business recovery team on alert status, but our buildings were located uphill from the river. We figured we'd come through high and dry, so we stayed on the job. Nobody imagined what was about to happen.
The people need to get out of here. It's going to be much worse than they thought. Two major roads washed out in the last 10 minutes and power lines are going down.
What about
another couple of hours? You may not have a road to get out on and no electricity. You may lose power at any time, so don't let your people get on the elevator.
Right. Attention, everyone. This is John Martin in security. We've just gotten word to evacuate the building. Please don't try to finish what you're doing. Leave the building. Now. Use the stairs.
We'd had drills to practice this kind of sudden evacuation. Everyone knew just what to do. Floor captains had flashlights, radios, cell phones, and checklists of employees in each section. They counted heads as people left the building. In 5.5 minutes, everyone was out. Except one.
Okay. Has anyone seen Ed Hanlon? Well, where's Hanlon?
Right there.
Hanlon carefully backed up his files and then stored the backup in his office. Never occurred to him that he might not be able to return for it. Minutes later, everyone was accounted for and we were all on the road.
When we abandoned ship, it was reasonable to assume we'd be back in a couple of days at worst. Then the sewer pipes broke. Sewage poured up into streets and yards and into our parking lots, basement, and even our street floor. The stench of pollution was everywhere. The Board of Health declared the entire area off limits until the sewer lines were repaired and environmental tests were done. A short-term disruption had turned into a long-term disaster. If anyone had any questions about the value of all of our planning and testing, this real crisis answered them. First of all, did we have a base of operations for recovery? Yes, we did. Hours after we left our building, we were there. A business recovery center had been set up in a training room at one of our own facilities 50 miles away. We had other alternate work locations, including a meeting room at a hotel and even company trailers. The center was fully equipped. Radios, TVs, satellite dishes, security devices, and phone and cable jacks for our computers. All we had to do was move in and plug in. There were hard copies of our recovery plan. There were directories of cell phone numbers and email addresses for all key people and their backups. This would be our war room for the next critical weeks.
Let's get a call from people back at corporate. So.
Were we prepared to assist our people and keep them in touch? Yes, we were. Every employee had a card with instructions, emergency cell phone and email contacts, and an 800 number to call for information.
Could we continue critical operations without stopping? Yes. Some functions switched right over to a mirror processing center where current data and transactions were installed or were accessed over the internet. To the outside world, we were in continuous operation. Except for Ed Hanlon, of course. His backups were right where he left them, at his workstation. Were we prepared to recover essential electronic records? Yes. 200 miles away, IT administrators set up shop in our leased hot site, where contingency computers were ready to roll. Backups and detailed up-to-date documentation were stored there. The plan provided for added personnel, transportation, and a realistic time frame for getting to the site and installing files. Were vital records safe and accessible? Yes, they were. They were stored off-site in 100% compliance with our record retention policies, so we were able to put our hands on vital records like insurance policies, blueprints of facilities, and system documentation, and other records on paper, photo, fiche, or electronic media. Digital archiving had become part of our normal contingency program, so we could recover critical paper documents in their original format, even if the originals were destroyed.
Were we prepared to relocate nearly 1,000 employees? Yes, we were. We had worked out contingency leasing agreements with office parks and conference centers in the region. We had an inventory of supplies and equipment we would need to replace, catalogs, purchase orders, and even home phone numbers for our suppliers.
Were we prepared to recover the majority of everything we handled that was paper? Yes, we were. Street-level offices were a mess, and other floors were dripping with moisture. Only at a moment like that do you fully appreciate how much data is not on electronic media, but on paper. Vital records on paper were stored off-site at facilities that meet national standards for fire resistance. Professional services were able to salvage many water-damaged paper documents and hard drives, disks, and chips.
In the confusion of the cleanup, there were a lot of unfamiliar faces working in the building. Were we prepared to maintain security? Absolutely. To start with, we established close liaison with local law enforcement. Access to the location was restricted. We issued new IDs and passes to employees and others authorized to enter the facility. People were so aware of who was who and what was coming in or going out the door, there were no thefts or leaks of information.
Were we prepared to keep people informed? We were. All inquiries from news media were funneled to the designated public information officer.
Never been neglected.
Hi, nice to see you. Good to see you.
Marketing and customer service staff made sure customers were never left in the dark.
Make sure that there were no problems on your end.
Human resources dealt with employees' individual problems, corrected false rumors, and answered questions about resumption of operations and returning to work.
Business recovery is never business as usual. It's a continuation of essential operations while working toward getting back to business as usual. On our road to business recovery, we hit some bumps and potholes, but we were ready for them. We were able to keep going full speed ahead.
Big or small, when disaster strikes, it's your job, your organization, maybe your life, that's on the line. Everyone has to be part of the program. When our flood emergency struck, every employee responded with well-practiced steps to ensure fellow workers' safety and to continue full operation. As far as clients and other outsiders could tell, it was a day like any other day, business as usual. Only we knew it was business as unusual. Thanks to making business continuity everyone's business, our organization is still standing and will be, no matter how hard we're hit. Come what may, you'll find us up and running and ready for anything.
Have a plan, yeah, yeah. Well, here's a plan. Good, thank you for that good transition there. You do have a plan, though. A records emergency action plan. This is something you might want to consider putting together for your court, for your office. And what this is something that you create before an incident, before a disaster emergency occurs. And what it is it details how your office, how your court is going to handle records should an incident occur. And there, you know, that's pretty, you know, a lot of it's just common sense. You know, what's the purpose of that? Planning ahead. It's trying to minimize loss to your records and information, try to reduce costs involved in salvaging those, like our folks at UT Medical Branch had to endure, unfortunately. And then what's going to happen during an incident with your records? And most times, records are going to be transferred somewhere else. There's a delay in your functions, your essential functions, so you want to try to delay that. A REAP is not your emergency plan. It's just one component of your emergency or your disaster plan or your COOP plan. It's that portion of that plan that deals with your records. And there's three components of a good or effective REAP. One is it needs to be comprehensive. It needs to address all the risks and hazards that you identify in your risk assessment to your record. It needs to be simple. Should be easy to follow and include checklists. In fact, a REAP is mandatory. There's several portions of a REAP that are required to be in checklist form so you can easily read them and follow them. And be flexible. The REAP should allow you to make quick decisions regardless of the size or complexity of the incident, whether it's a little small fire in an office or maybe a hurricane, approaching hurricane. Just like with your emergency plans, your REAP should be reviewed on a regular basis to make sure it's current, and we recommend you do that annually. Once a year is what you should do. Same with those inventories. A lot of times people ask, well, how often should you do one? Well, you might want to do it once a year. Keep up with. Depends on the records you generate. And I think you all probably generate quite a bit of records. From what I heard talking with this gentleman during the first break, is they have quite a few records in their court. So I'm sure you're all probably in the same boat, unfortunately. Now, every organization is unique, right? Everybody has their own risk and your own budgets and your own resources. No two REAPs are going to be the same. Your REAP is not going to be the same as hers once you put them together. But every REAP should have common components in them. We don't have enough time to talk about them this afternoon, but these are the common components of a REAP that you should have in your REAP, your Records Emergency Action Plan. If you'd like more information on this, please feel free to contact me. I'll be happy to send you more information about it. Back here with three handouts that I brought for you all, I have some business cards. So please, if you'd like, grab one, and I'd be glad to send you some information about this. It's really quite easy. Once you start going through it, you'll see it does look a little daunting, but once you go through it and you get people to work with you, you can put one of these together. Again, it's not your emergency management plan. It's just a component of your emergency plan that focuses on your records, what your court will do with your records, how you're going to handle them when that disaster or emergency occurs. So how do you respond? How do you respond to a records emergency? We can't anticipate every incident, can we? Unfortunately, we can't. My crystal ball doesn't work, nor does my magic eight ball. I don't know if yours does or not. So what you want to do is you first want to assess the damage to your records. That's meant to be humorous up there, those pictures. You first want to try to determine the nature and severity of the damage. So if you had a fire, was it just contained in that filing cabinet under that coffee machine that you have? Or was a major portion of your court building burned? Were records charred, where you can't even read what they were? Or maybe they just smell smoky? You want specifics. Water damage. Is that water clean or dirty? You have 2 inches of standing water, or is it 20 inches of standing water? Are records damp? Are they soggy? These are the things that you want to be determining and jotting it down as well. Document the volume of the records that were affected by the incident and the extent. Take notes, take photos or videos. The location of the records and the nature of the damage, the cause of the damage. And identifying the records that are affected, you want to be very, very specific. Not just, okay, case papers, dockets. Specifically, what type of case papers, what type of dockets? That's where you need to get your records management officer involved to find out what's the record number, what's the record title or name, dates and dates, what's the media of the record, what's the volume or quantity. This will come in handy later. Remember earlier we were talking about access priorities, how soon you want to access certain records following an incident. Remember how many we have? Oh, your paying attention. Get your mirror. It's the easy three. I was going to see if I can catch somebody. Records you need in the first, what, 12 hours are priority one. Records in the, what, 12 to 72 is priority two. Records you need after the first 72 hours, priority three. Your salvage priorities should mirror those access priorities. The records you're going to need to access in the first 12 hours are the ones you're going to need to salvage first. And so on. In that second bullet there, in recovering your essential records and valuable records first, well, I think we all agree essential records are valuable. What are the other records that we would consider valuable? I kind of touched on it a little bit earlier when I asked a question, how many of you handle certain types of documents? What's that? Records that have sensitive or confidential information? And how about records that, by law, have permanent retention? You want to consider those valuable. Records that you're required to keep forever. And then, of course, we can't neglect the other records. You need to be concerned with the other records. So, you want to recover those essential records and those records that have permanent retention and or sensitive or confidential information in them. Once you do that, then you need to look at the records. Determine if your other records have adequate backup. And if they do, then you can focus your attention and efforts to other records. So I know you're all thinking, man, I hope that incident that occurs is really, really small. Because I'm in a world of hurt. I don't blame you. I'd be stressing a little bit too. When you implement your response to a records emergency, your first priority is obviously safety and health of the people. Because you're gonna go in, this is going on the assumption that you're the ones that are gonna respond to this. And then once the emergency personnel have said it's safe to go back into your facility, into your building, then there's that first priority. Is that the health and safety issues, especially if you had something happen like on the video, that water, that's contaminated water. So there's certain things you want to make sure that people are prepared. So waterproof gloves, adequate footwear, long pants, long sleeve shirts. If there's standing water, you need to be careful. You might trip on something. There might be wires. We've heard stories of electrical wires, depending on how severe the incident is, where wires are touching the standing water. I don't know about you, but I don't want to walk into a part of my office that has a wire stuck in the standing water. I'll let somebody else do it. Maybe masks. You might need some masks. And you might need the special masks, depending on the condition. And depending on the person that's going around, you know, maybe one of your employees, your fellow workers, has maybe asthma. Bronchitis. My brother has asthma. I know pollen season gets him. So you might need a mask with a HEPA filter, high efficiency particulate air filter, those fancy ones. Might need flashlights, hard hats. You might want to have this kit nearby. Now, maybe you have somebody else that's responsible for this if something's going to happen at your facility. I don't know, do you? Will somebody else come in and go through and find the records? Or maybe you're going to be stuck with doing it. At our facility, we'd be doing it. And if you have, when you're responding and you're going through things like lifting heavy objects, guess what happens to records when they get wet? They get heavy. A box of records may not look like much, but when that gets wet, some guy is trying to estimate to me what the percentage of weight increase. Like, I know, all I know is it's going to be. So don't try to move off. Do the buddy system. Get somebody else to help you move those items. And then security and privacy is your second priority, because in about every incident, your records are going to be relocated. They're going to be taken somewhere else. So guess what is going to increase? What threat's going to increase by moving them to another location? Good, you're close. Right. The threat of, or the risk of theft. Vandalism. So what do you think you need to do? Word, access. You need to make sure that only authorized people have access to that area where those records, so if you evacuate them, that's when the incident occurs, but hopefully you're able to do that before your records are damaged. Sensitive confidential documents, what did we say earlier about them? Make sure they're clearly labeled, marked. Hopefully they are in your offices, in your courts. Right now they're clearly labeled and marked. If not, that's something you might want to look into having done. Have it done so if something happens, you already have them labeled. Any questions? Insurance adjusters say the number one risk to records is water damage. Anybody surprised about that one? I don't think so, yeah. Think about potential incidents. If you had a broken water pipe, if you had a fire, what do the firemen use to put out the fire? Water. If you had wind damage, a tornado, part of the roof or the walls torn off, you're going to have your records open to water. Good chance of it. So you're going to have to cover materials potentially. You have standing water, remove it. Using, what do you think? Hopefully not buckets. Sump pumps, wet vacs. Good. I used to have one. Anybody have a wet vac? You may not have one, but might want to talk to somebody else in your town. Might come in handy. Environmental control done earlier with our folks in Danville. Very, very important to get the temperature and humidity down and keep it stabilized. Temperature should be no higher than 65 degrees Fahrenheit and relative humidity no higher than 50%. That's very important. Get the air circulating. Now, it's great if you still have electricity. You can use fans. What if you don't have electricity? What are some other options to get the air circulating? Generators, but don't they cost lots of money? Maybe you guys are better off than our state aid. We don't even have. I asked that question when we were doing the site survey, and our building manager said, oh, we don't have portable generators. Bingo. Yeah, open some windows. Hopefully it's not like Danville where you can't open the windows, but I'm picking on Danville Municipal Court. Man. Is that a real town? I didn't even check to see if that's a real town or not in Texas. Yeah, open some doors and windows. Get the air circulating. Extremely, extremely important. And I'll share a story with you, a personal one. It was a month ago. Let's say within the last 2 months, I had a water incident occur at my apartment. I came home and found out my water heater. And I had several boxes. Don't ask me why. Now I know. Now it's plastic containers. I had some boxes near the water heater that got soaked. And I had some personal items in them get wet, of which were numerous photos of my daughter through various stages of her life. And I had to lay them out on, and I'm going to show you a video here quickly. I laid them out on my kitchen counter on top of sheets of paper towels, and I had to dab them, blot them, so they weren't damaged or destroyed. I was really stressing that night. And I had a little small photo album that was paper pages with pictures on them, and I had to set it on a table and fan it. And I had a fan going near them, and I had a fan going in the room where the water heater was, to let that dry and get that temperature and humidity down, mainly the humidity. I had my air conditioner going, but to get that humidity down. What's the thing that can happen and then just exacerbate the whole situation? Yes. Oh, my gosh. Ever have that happen? I've heard some horror stories. Mold gets on records, and you got to be careful about using fans. If you have any reason to believe that you have mold in that office area, do not use fans. You will just make matters worse. Blow those spores all over the place, and then your records will be worse. So, yeah, water damage is the most common risk to records. And what I'm going to show you, you need a break here. I'll make sure your blood's not pooling in your legs. And show you a brief video here that's going to talk about recovering items and records from water damage and what to do. And this is a pretty cool picture. And then I will talk a little bit more about it and kind of wrap things up, get you out of here before, more than likely, certainly by 5, if not before. That's my goal, is before 5, because I know you're all thirsty and hungry. And I am. Well, I heard it's supposedly over 100 outside. And it's 102 in Austin, so that's just too hot. I don't know about. Is any of this stuff giving you some ideas? You think, go back, talk with other people at least. You can't solve this overnight. This is something that it's going to take baby steps. But one of my life mantras is some is better than none. So hopefully you'll take that to heart and you'll at least take some measures. Yes, ma'am. Really? Put that on the eval, please.
Water is by far the most common cause of damage to museum, library, and archive collections. But all water is not the same. Think of the difference, for instance, between the contents of a burst sewage pipe, what drips down from a leaky roof, and seawater from coastal flooding. Knowing what kind of water you're dealing with is essential, certainly, to planning what salvage actions you'll take, but most importantly, to your safety.
You're going to want to know, is that water that's clean water, or is that water that's potentially contaminated? It may contain things that you don't want to come into contact with. So you're going to want to know the nature of the water before handling anything that's been in water.
Emergency authorities on site will know of any health or safety hazards in the water, and they'll likely be the ones to give you the okay to enter the area. In the meantime, make sure you're wearing protective clothing, like a long-sleeve shirt, long pants, a hard hat, waterproof gloves, sturdy rubber boots, and safety glasses to protect your eyes from splashes. Also, make sure you've got a cell phone or walkie-talkie and a partner to work with. As for other gear, bring a still or video camera if possible, as well as pens, pencils, and paper for note-taking and documenting. Finally, along with a supply of absorbent materials, you may need some special tools or equipment.
Things that are useful are things like wet vacs that can suck up water, sump pumps, dehumidifiers, fans, and some basic equipment like that that will help you eliminate as much water as possible. If you have a really huge problem, you may need to get help from a contractor who does emergency response with water emergencies.
Remember, be careful when handling or transporting objects that have been in water for any length of time. They're sure to be fragile and heavier than usual.
You really have to make sure that you are stabilizing the objects as you're transporting them, meaning having carts and things to transport them. Never carry a wet box just on its own, because you never know when the box is going to give way.
You'll want to dry or freeze objects as soon as possible to prevent mold, so sort them by degree of wetness. If you have small quantities of items that are damp but not soaked, air drying is an effective method. For this, you'll need time and good air circulation.
And then you need surface space, because you need to lay everything out and spread it out. You need to fan open books. You need to separate, say, a mat from a print, so that the air can actually get to the object so that it can dry it out. You're going to need blotters, table coverings, and lots of manpower probably to do air drying.
You want to have fans going, but you don't want the fans directed specifically at the objects. You want to increase the level of air circulation so that material will most effectively dry.
When you're air drying, objects need to be turned and flipped frequently to speed drying and minimize warping. Photographs can be dried in several ways.
You can either dry them by clipping them to a clothesline, or you can dry them flat on absorbent material. If you do dry them flat, you just have to be careful of puddling on the top of the photographs. You can take an absorbent material and just very, very gently try to wick up some of that moisture.
Make sure the photographs are dried with the image side up. Be prepared, though. It might take as much as 2 weeks to get things thoroughly dry. One way to help speed up drying is a technique called interleaving.
Interleaving is just a piece of absorbent material. It can be newsprint, it can be paper toweling, it can be blotters. And simply what you're doing is cutting a piece of paper a little bit larger than the size of the text block of the book and just inserting it between pages to help assist drawing out some of that moisture more quickly from the pages. You maybe want to interleave maybe every 25, 50 pages.
Drying can also be done outdoors. However, keep most objects away from direct sunlight. Some items, like coated paper, should not be air-dried at all. In situations where you don't have the personnel or the space to air-dry, or you have too many wet objects and very little time, freezing may be your best option.
What you can do is put many of your collections into a freezer, a chest freezer, or it might even be a large freezer truck that has been moved onto site. It buys you time. It prevents mold from growing. And then when you have the luxury of time, materials, and volunteers, staff, and you've established a treatment process, you can take them out of the freezer, either one at a time, a box at a time, and then spread them out and dry them in a more controlled atmosphere.
Keep in mind that some objects like paintings, furniture, and electronic media should never be frozen. If you have any questions, contact a conservator or refer to the emergency response and salvage wheel. Now, to freeze objects, pack them in sturdy containers made of waterproof material. Keep wet objects separate from damp ones. And use freezer or wax paper to prevent objects from touching each other. Then, pack objects in a single layer.
For books, you would wrap them with a piece of butcher paper and then put them into a milk crate or crates. They usually go in spine down into the crate.
During the salvage effort, you may hear terms like vacuum freeze drying and thermal or vacuum drying. These are all drying techniques that must be done by professionals. A detailed explanation can be found in your field guide or salvage wheel. Sometimes, the best option is keeping items wet by storing them in clean water. This is useful for coated papers like magazines. If it's not possible to freeze them right away, you can keep them in cool, clean water up to 24 hours. Salty, dirty, or contaminated water presents specific salvage problems. If allowed to dry on materials like metal, leather, ceramic, or paper, it can be very destructive. In these cases, rinsing objects exposed to salty or contaminated water may be the best option.
You would decide to rinse an object if you were sure that the object was stable enough to handle being rinsed. Some objects are more fragile than others. If there are metal objects or maybe wooden objects, if you have bins that you can set up to actually immerse the objects and progressively cleaner water, like three or four bins, and keep changing the water out. Your last bath, you know, make sure the water in the bin is relatively clean. If you're considering rinsing off a paper object or maybe a photograph, and it's a single layer, just like one photograph, not a stack of photographs stuck together or in an album, you'll want to make sure you give that some support. You can put it on a piece of plexiglass and put it at an angle, and then use a hose and spray the front of that object and then turn it over and do the reverse side. If you have books, don't open the book up when you go to rinse it. Make sure you hold that book closed really tightly, and you just want to rinse off the cover and just give that a good rinse. You don't want to deal with trying to open that book up and rinsing individual pages because, once again, they're paper, they're very vulnerable.
Guidelines for rinsing wet ceramics and glass objects are pretty clear-cut.
If you're looking at a bunch of objects and you're considering which ones do I want to rinse first, you want to go through your ceramics, starting with the lowest fired ceramics to the higher fired ceramics like porcelain, and then do your glass.
If they've been immersed in contaminated or salt water, take care of them right away. But if they've been in relatively clean water, you can deal with them after salvaging objects with higher priority. Before placing ceramic items in a plastic bag, make sure they're completely dry to stop any potential mold growth. Corrosion is another of several problems water can create. Metal objects immersed in salt or contaminated water should be rinsed in clean water as soon as possible and then air dry. This helps prevent the corrosion from setting in. For more information, refer to the sections on mold and corrosion on this DVD. You might also want to check out the other segments on mud and bleeding and dye transfer. The bottom line is, when in doubt about how to salvage wet objects, consult a conservator, the Field Guide to Emergency Response, or the Emergency Response and Salvage Wheel.